many judges are fixers. We want to help people. And if we can do that quickly, it's incredibly satisfying.
An innovative court program that encourages settlement in divorce and custody cases. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, April 2nd. Good evening, I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, a government oversight agency raises questions about responding to an oil spill in the Arctic Ocean.
The key difference is with the Arctic is that in the Arctic, that infrastructure is quite limited at present.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline for 35 years. The Association of Alaska School Boards believes that all students should be proficient in reading, writing, and math by the time they finish the third grade. More information at aasb.org. This message sponsored by the Association of Alaska School Boards.
State House Speaker Mike Chenault says it's very unlikely an oil tax bill will pass before the legislative session's scheduled adjournment. That raises the potential for a special session, but that's not a foregone conclusion. Representative Craig Johnson says House members will analyze the bill to see if it accomplishes the goals of spurring investment and boosting production. If it doesn't, and the House and Senate can't compromise, he says lawmakers have the option of saying they'll take it up next year. The Senate Finance Committee is working on the bill. Co-chair Bert Stedman has said it would be nice to have a rewrite of SB 192 before the committee by week's end. That would leave the House days to consider the proposal if an April 15th adjournment is to be met. A new report from the Government Accountability Office, or GAO, raises questions about Shell's plan to drill exploratory wells in the Arctic Ocean this summer. The report, released on Friday, finds the Interior Department has strengthened oversight of oil and gas operators since the Deepwater Horizon spill in the Gulf of Mexico. It also says the industry is in a better position to respond to a similar blowout-type incident, but the report points out containing a spill in the Arctic would be much more difficult. Frank Rusko, an author of the report, says that's partly because ice will form over the ocean in the fall and winter.
So if an event such as a blowout were to occur near the time when ice is going to start forming, that just adds to the complexity and the difficulties in response.
The Department of Interior has already approved Shell's spill response plans for drilling in the Beaufort and Chukchi Seas beginning this July. Rusko emphasizes GAO has not reviewed or commented on those plans and is not suggesting the Interior Department or Shell are doing anything improper. He says the industry has made great strides in minimizing the risks of drilling in the Gulf of Mexico, but that success does not necessarily translate to the Arctic.
A lot of that preparation and response is contingent on there being in the Gulf a lot of infrastructure that is owned by industry. And the key difference is that with the Arctic is that in the Arctic, that infrastructure is quite limited at present.
The Interior Department would only respond for a request for comment with a brief email statement saying the agency, quote, conducted exhaustive reviews of the plans and continues to hold the operators accountable with additional exercises, reviews, and inspections. Divorce can lead to a messy and drawn-out legal battle, but in Anchorage, an innovative court program is helping divorcing couples settle their cases quickly and amicably. It's called the Early Resolution Project, and it offers free legal advice to litigants right in the courthouse. It's been so successful, two other Alaska cities are already adopting the model. APRN's Annie Fite attended an early resolution court hearing recently and has this story.
This is a serious story about the legal system and divorce. And one thing I did not expect to hear during my afternoon in court is laughter.
So I'm just sort of recording,
sure.
If that's okay?
Yeah.
And what's your name?
Jacob Carpenter.
Jacob and Taya Carpenter just finished negotiating a divorce. They were married for 10 years and have two kids, so it was complicated. But they say the advice they got from the Early Resolution Project helped it go smoothly.
Jacob and I get along pretty well, and we've been able to communicate.
We either agreed on everything or didn't hold on too strong to the stuff that we wanted.
That's the type of cooperation Superior Court Judge Stephanie Joannides imagined when she came up with the seed of the idea for the Early Resolution Project 3 years ago. Divorce and child custody cases were crowding her court schedule, and the cases took too long to resolve. Judge Joannides says it could be months before a couple had their initial court date, and at that point, they tended to be entrenched in their positions.
So all these people are doubly in conflict by then, and I thought, what if we could set these cases early and I could try to resolve them early?
Now, every 2 weeks, Anchorage Superior Court devotes a Friday afternoon to hearing the early resolution cases. On the afternoon I visit, Judge Joannides is hearing 7 divorce cases.
Please rise. Superior Court for the State of Alaska is now in session. The Honorable Judge Joannides presiding.
Please be seated.
As court proceedings go, it's remarkably informal. While the judge begins hearing the first few cases, couples meet with lawyers in the jury gathering room down the hall. Occasionally, the lawyers duck out of the room to confer with each other about their clients' positions. Stacey Mars manages the Early Resolution Project. Mars says the program basically fine-tunes the legal process to encourage settlement.
This is the first project that I'm aware of where there is pro bono legal services happening right in the courtroom. So it's addressing how do we get people without attorneys legal advice and how do we do it in real time in a court proceeding. So that's what's unique.
The work begins well before the parties arrive in court. Mars says they scan the initial divorce and custody court filings looking for hints that couples may be willing to settle.
Basically, if it looks like they have the ability to work together in any fashion, if there's any clues in the file from the paperwork that has been filed, that they have some agreements or they look like they could reach agreements, we're going to try to give them an opportunity to be part of the project.
The program's success rate is impressive. 80% of the cases are resolved quickly, most in just one court hearing. And couples don't even have to wait to receive their divorce decree or custody papers in the mail. They're printed out right in the courtroom. Judge Joannides says it used to be rare to settle cases in one hearing. Now it's common.
Many judges are fixers. We want to help people. We want to help them resolve their dispute. And if we can do that quickly, it's incredibly satisfying.
The Early Resolution Project has been so successful. Courts in Palmer and Juneau are replicating it. Several court systems around the country have also inquired about the program. Back at the Anchorage Court, Jacob and Taya Carpenter are finalizing their divorce with Judge Joannides.
And I want to commend both of you for working cooperatively to come up with a mutually agreeable resolution. It's clear that
for Jacob and Taya, getting their case resolved quickly with free lawyers at their side helped them make the best of a bad situation.
It made it a lot less stressful.
And for us, I mean, it's probably was the difference between ruining two people financially, maybe. I mean, I don't know, you know,
yeah.
that's appropriate
accurate
way to say it. You know, and now two people can walk away kind of just better.
According to their lawyers, Jacob and Taya are good divorcers. And even though they couldn't preserve their marriage, the Early Resolution Project did help them preserve a workable relationship. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the debate over native craft rules for otter pelts in Southeast.
Once Alaska Natives are being told by an agency outside of our culture what we can and can't do, it no longer is our art.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
When you've made the decision to stop smoking, whether you've tried to quit before or it's the very first time, there are free and confidential resources available proven successful in helping you quit for good. Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line offers nicotine replacement therapy, confidential counseling, and support services. Because everyone is different, trained quit coaches will tailor a quit plan just for you. For more information, call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or visit alaskaquitline.com.
It's election season in Anchorage, and you can't drive around the city without seeing signs for incumbent Mayor Dan Sullivan and challenger Paul Honeyman. But there are actually 6 candidates running for city's mayor. KSKA's Daisha Eaton explains.
KSKA and KAKM invited all the mayoral candidates to appear on our running program last week. Four candidates accepted: Dan Sullivan, Paul Honeyman, Phil Isley, and Bob Lupo. Sullivan, who served as mayor for the past 3 years, maintains he's doing a good job and should be reelected.
When I ran 3 years ago, I said I was going to restore fiscal discipline to the city. I was going to work on getting crime, particularly violent crime, down. I wanted to take a leadership role in energy for South Central. And I wanted to work to maintain our public assets. I think we've done a good job in all those areas.
Honeyman, who after a long career in law enforcement, has served on the Anchorage Assembly for the past 2 years, representing East Anchorage, says he's running for mayor for three reasons.
The first is to restore the public process to the municipal government. The second is to restore your faith in the budget and finances of the municipality. And lastly, I believe we must perform our services and programs of the municipality better, and I believe I'm that person.
The candidates are divided on several issues, including controversial Proposition 5, the Anchorage Equal Rights Amendment, which would add protections in housing and employment for gays, lesbians, and transgender people to municipal code. Sullivan opposes the measure. He vetoed a similar measure that passed the Assembly in 2009.
And the reason I did was that after literally 800 people testified, about half for, about half against, and there was not one single documented incident where someone had lost their job or lost their housing because of their sexuality.
Honeyman supports Prop 5.
You know, in 2012, it's just silly that we're even debating whether or not people are equal and they deserve equal rights and respect.
Phil Isley and Bob Lupo have both run before without success. Neither have served in public office.
I'm honest. I'm old. I think I know what's going on. I've been a resident here for 31 years.
That's 71-year-old Lupo, who served in the military and taught electronics at the University of Alaska. Phil Isley says he's running to give people a choice.
I believe that we can change it. I'd like to see us change it more, probably to make it more like it was when I was younger, to where we had more industry, more private sector business.
Isley says he'd like to see more people get involved with their government and change it.
I'd like to point out that there's four other candidates, although sometimes you may not notice that because we don't get much coverage in the news.
On the fringe are Jacob Seth Kern and Bruce J. Lemke, neither of whom have actively campaigned. According to a poll conducted last week by Dittman Research and Communications, Sullivan leads Honeyman by a large margin. Matt Larkin is the president of Dittman and managed the poll, which was done by telephone. Larkin says pollsters asked voters whether they were voting for Sullivan or Honeyman.
56% responded Dan Sullivan, 35% Paul Honeyman. 8% are undecided, and 1% indicated they intend to vote for somebody else. It indicates very strong support for current Mayor Sullivan.
Another poll by Dittman Research and Communications found support for Proposition 5. 50% said they would vote yes, while 41% said no. 9% said they were undecided. Voters will also decide on 7 other ballot measures. The polls are open from 7 a.m. to 8 p.m. across Anchorage tomorrow. In Anchorage, I'm Daisha Eaton.
Hydropower is common in some parts of the state, but there are no such projects in western or southwest Alaska. That could change, though, as oil prices and, in turn, energy prices continue to rise. From member station KYUK in Bethel, Angela Denning-Barnes reports.
An open house on bringing hydropower to the YK Delta took place in Bethel Wednesday evening at the Cultural Center. Several informational tables were set up around the room, with maps and graphs covering the walls. Most visitors seemed to be arriving with an open mind to the idea of the Jacuminik Lake Project, which would allegedly power Bethel and 13 nearby villages.
I'm here to get more info on it.
One of them was Myron Fitka from the village of Tuntutuliak, near the mouth of the Kuskokwim.
There was a small presentation on it earlier, and it sounded pretty interesting.
And what's your name?
Clarence Daniel.
What do you think about the idea of hydropower?
It's a good opportunity to lower energy costs, and if it comes in, it'll be a good benefit to the people.
Optimistically, the Jacuminik Lake Project would take 10 years and $500 million to study and build. The legislature last year gave $10 million to the project to get it started. The project is being spearheaded by the nonprofit cooperative, NuVista Light and Power, whose mission is to bring cheaper energy to the YK Delta. The main players include the regional nonprofit, Association of Village Council Presidents, the regional for-profit corporation, Chilista, and the Yukon-Kuskokwim Health Corporation. YKHC President Gene Paltola.
The price of gases and stove oil has gone up considerably over the last 5-6 years. It's going to go up some more. It's at the point now heating and electrification is almost not affordable in the Delta.
Over the past 40 years, there have been dozens of reports on alternative energy projects for the region. Coal power, nuclear power, wind, and biomass have all been looked at. NuVista has been part of that mission for over 15 years, most of those years under the leadership of Christine Klein at Chilista. She says wind energy works for some villages, but not others.
For long-term energy needs, it needed to be something basically that could provide more power on a stable basis year-round.
As NuVista pursued energy from water, a dozen possible sites were looked at since 2007. Last year, they settled on Chicoutimi, which is believed to have no spawning fish. The lake is located about 120 miles southeast of Bethel in the Wood Tikchik State Park. It's actually closer to the Dillingham area, and the watershed flows that way too. That could seem like a conflict, but Klein says they are collaborating with Bristol Bay.
There's actually been quite a good deal of interest on that side of the range for power if this project is feasible.
So would that be like sharing the project possibly, or whoever gets it done first?
That's a good question. I would hope it would be a joint effort at some point.
That would be phase B. We haven't got to that point yet.
Elaine Brown is NuVista's director since last August, when the board found enough money to pay for staffing.
When we go out there this summer, determine what kind of megawattage that the lake will be able to produce by the flow of the water and so on. So that may determine tying in Bristol Bay and Dillingham.
There's a meeting scheduled for May with the Wood Tikchik Advisory Council that will be followed by an informational open house in Dillingham. Over the next year, NuVista will be conducting preliminary field work through the engineering group Hatch. In Bethel, I'm Angela Denning-Barnes.
The Native Youth Olympics season is in full swing across Alaska. Recently, Bethel Regional High School's NYO team faced off with 20 other teams from across western Alaska. The meet was the first contest of the year for the hometown team. From KYUK in Bethel, Mark Earhart has more.
Over 30 middle school and high school students ran around the gym warming up before practice, glancing at balls suspended by line well above the reach of most people's feet. But somehow, some way, after running laps, these students launched into the air and hit the balls with their toes. These athletes are part of the school's Native Youth Olympics team, practicing for a big meet that took place over the weekend.
It's our first and last meet. 20 teams are coming, and there's about 200-plus students coming.
That's 10th grader Rihanna Joseph. She competed in the Alaskan one-foot toe kick, the seal hop, and the toe jump. Joseph says she's been competing in NYO since the fifth grade. Her coach, Tommy Bayayuk, has been coaching NYO teams since 1994 and the BRHS team since 2009. He says he's excited about this year's team.
Quite a few students returning from state have high expectations and should be fun.
The team hosted teams from across western Alaska, including Akiachuk, Akiak, Agula, Atmautluk, Chefornik, Dillingham, Eek, Good News Bay, Kipnuk, Kodiak, Kungiginuk, Quigilinguk, McGrath, Newtok, Nightmute, Nome, Nunapichuk, Oscarville, Tuxuk Bay, Tuliksak, and Tununik.
The events are the one-foot high kick, two-foot high kick, Alaskan high kick, one-hand reach, seal hop, Indian stick pull, Eskimo stick pull, wrist carry, kneel jump, and toe kick.
The NYO season was to start earlier this year, but the team's first meet was canceled due to poor weather. That leaves just a little under a month before the state tournament in Anchorage. Bayayuk says he expects 8 students or more to compete at state this year. Joseph says she's excited about the uniqueness of NYO as a sport.
It's individual, but you're still a team. So it's fun. That's what makes fun.
I'm Mark Earhart.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska, providing quality health plans to companies and individuals in Alaska for over 60 years. More at Primera.com. Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska. We know the territory. And by the Pebble Partnership, developing a comprehensive mine plan that meets Alaska's regulatory requirements while supporting sustainable fisheries in Southwest Alaska. PebblePartnership.com.
Federal officials say they are trying to clarify rules for Alaskan natives' use of sea otters. A draft set of guidelines from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is aimed at addressing some of the confusion over what's allowed, but it's been a frustrating situation for native hunters. KFSK's Matt Lichtenstein reports.
Ketchikan Indian Community Tribal Council member Andre LeCornu gave his opinion on the issue at a recent joint meeting of the Southeast Regional Subsistence Advisory Council and Alaska's Federal Subsistence Board. He blamed federal law enforcement actions for impeding Alaska Natives' ability to make money from sea otter hunting and artwork. LeCornu noted that his grandfather worked as an otter hunter, and LeCornu hunts them as well.
I'm not an artisan. I couldn't make a coat, and I certainly can't make some of the fancy teddy bears that some of our good artists are able to do. But other people have a right to make a livelihood and not just subsist.
Sea otters are a federally protected species. The Marine Mammal Protection Act only allows Alaska Natives to hunt them. They may take them for subsistence and to share or sell to other Alaska Natives. They may also sell authentic Native articles of handicrafts and clothing made from otter to non-Natives. There are no bag limits or seasons, but kills must not be wasteful and they must be reported to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. According to Special Agent in Charge Stan Przinski, law enforcement has tried to focus its efforts on hunting by non-natives, which is completely illegal, as well as the sale of unaltered pelts to non-natives, which the law also prohibits.
There has been a lot of information about hides being sent overseas, smuggled out of the country to furriers and other people in other countries who want raw pelts to make their own handicraft, to make their own clothing for resale.
As far as crafts and clothing made from otter, fish and wildlife officials say they are trying to provide additional guidance on what is legal to sell outside the native community. The agency has released a set of draft guidelines for this. The key point, according to spokesperson Bruce Woods, is that the otter hide should be modified enough so a buyer cannot easily return it to its original unaltered condition without damaging it.
You see, the whole point of these is to prevent what would essentially be unaltered sea otter hides getting out of the hands of the native handicrafters and going to someone who is non-native, who can perhaps less expensively duplicate the same kind of handicrafts and eliminate the market that the native handicrafters have for these materials.
U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service regulations specify that items sold to non-natives must be significantly altered from their natural form. But this regulatory language and the new guidelines are problematic for some hunters and artists such as Peter Williams of Sitka. Williams prefers the broader language of the law itself.
The Marine Mammal Protection Act exemption for Alaska Natives already gives a definition of authentic native handicraft.
He asserts that the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is undermining the intent of the law, which allows Alaska Natives to continue their customary and traditional use of marine mammals.
They're implementing it in a way that's dictating to us what we can and can't make. And the problem with that is once Alaska Natives are being told by an agency outside of our culture what we can and can't do, it no longer is our art. It's no longer our traditions. It's somebody else's.
Williams has organized the Sea Otter Handicraft Coalition, a group of individuals and businesses that sew with sea otter. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service originally asked people to comment on the draft guidelines by March 31st, but that's been pushed back. Agency officials now say people are welcome to submit comments up to and including the date when final guidelines come out, which may be sometime this fall. In Petersburg, I'm Matt Lichtenstein.
Alaska Community Action on Toxics was in Savunga last week offering workshops on advancing environmental justice and human rights. KNOM's Matthew Smith has the story.
Thousands of miles separate Mossville, Louisiana from Savunga, Alaska, but both communities say they've endured years of severe environmental pollution, all with the tacit approval of the federal government. After several lackluster cleanup efforts and years of struggle, Mossville has taken a dramatic step. It's taking the United States government to international court for human rights violations. And one lawyer helping Mossville with their case against the federal government says the same federal system that polluted Mossville is at fault in Savunga.
From both the migration of toxic chemicals that can build up in concentration through the food chain here in Savunga, along with the waste left behind by the military, we have a community that, through acts of government, is suffering the injustice of a human rights violation.
That's Monique Hardin, an attorney and the co-director of Advocates for Environmental Human Rights in New Orleans. She's in Savunga this week offering workshops on environmental health and justice aimed at sharing the legal counsel and advocacy support that helped her firm win important environmental victories. Hardin is in Savunga through Alaska Community Action on Toxics, or ACAT. Vi Wahi was born and raised in Savunga and is ACAT's Environmental Health and Justice Program Director. She's worked with ACAT to address concerns on global transport of contaminants to Arctic air, soil, and water, and she's worked to address toxins at abandoned military sites on St. Lawrence Island. She says years of struggle with the military and the government have left many residents in Savunga with dangerously toxic subsistence resources and a history of health problems. And they're turning to ACAT for help.
State and federal agencies have not come forward to help us. The burden of proof has been put on us. The reason why we bring in Monique Hardin is the communities of St. Lawrence Island have been asking us in how we can help advocate for them and how to help them find a tool to hold the military and industries accountable.
Hardin says Mossville is looking for non-compensatory remedies to problems caused by the pollution in their community. And in her first workshop Wednesday, a woman's talking group, she says residents of Savunga have voiced similar goals.
Those include health services and health monitoring and evaluation and medical treatment for members of the community that are suffering severe health problems. And the conversation that we had in the women's circle with women of Savunga, the idea around health services was something that was discussed as a possibility.
Vi Wahi says the people of Savunga and ACAT will continue to seek remedy for the pollution that afflicts their community, and she says they'll be watching the progress of Mossville's case against the government very, very closely. Reporting in Savunga, I'm Matthew Smith.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Dacia Eaton in Anchorage, Angela Denning Barnes and Mark Earhart in Bethel, Matt Lichtenstein in Petersburg, and Matthew Smith in Savunga. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Kristen Spack is our web producer. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Bristol Bay Native Corporation, generations of jobs, heritage, and history. Bristol Bay, a place that's always been. Online at bbnc.net. Join Alaska bars and restaurants from every corner of the state in taking a stand against secondhand smoke. The fact of the matter is, no Alaskan, employee, or customer should suffer the heart disease and lung cancer due to secondhand smoke. The benefits are undeniably positive for Alaskans and for the bottom line. Clean indoor air. It's good for health, and it's great for business. For more information on smoke-free workplaces, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
You can find APRN headlines and more online at alaskapublic.org. Local, national, and international news, upcoming events, and statewide community conversation. alaskapublic.org, connecting you to Alaska one story at a time.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.